It's amazing to think how dependent we've become on our computers when just maybe 30 years ago, they were rare and not very accessible for the average person. But for better or worse, computers are a large part of our everyday life now, which means when something goes wrong with our machine, it can affect many different parts of our lives. Well, lucky for us, we have Peter Green to help. Peter is an independent computer consultant, and he comes by the first Monday of each month to help us all with our computer problems. Peter, great to have you back.
Always great, Judith.
And so, Peter, you had, as a theme today, you had when to hit the panic button. And I think that sometimes we're a little quick on hitting the panic button. But it can be hard to know when it's serious and when it's not. There are a lot of things that can go wrong with our computers. What are some symptoms of a more minor problem, would you say?
First, I'm going to take a step back. One is people say, well, what does a consultant do? People specialize in different things, and I specialize in probably system problems. And system problems include integration between hardware, software, network. The internet came along, so I was doing stuff before you know, the internet became popular. And in fact, we used this show to promote it, and people would say, you know, how do you know these things are reliable? And I said, it will get there.
And
look
and here
where
we are.
Look where we are today. So. When I say, okay, what do I do? How do I approach things? You have to rule things out. And the only way to rule things out is to start taking notes. When you have a problem, you should have, and I've talked about this many times, have a little booklet or a pad of paper. And you should almost like, if you want to keep it a loose diary of your computer use and your experience and problems you might have. And if you have an error message that comes up, don't ignore it. Take notes on it. And, yeah, there are tricks to, you know, doing print screens, and you could do that if you want. You know, you could search how to do print screens on PCs and on Macs. There are ways to do that.
And that's basically taking a picture of what's on the screen.
Yep. So you have, you know, you have it exactly, and then you can type it in and search on it. And it's a good idea to search and find out the background of those error messages and see if there's something else going on, you know, what's the cause of it? What might else be going on? And a lot of people have posted questions about error messages, and you'll usually find something out there. So then, is it a hardware error message? Is it a software error message? Is it a network connectivity error message? You might have a small network in your home, or it might be related to the business. Or is it an internet connection error message, you know, not getting your email? So there are a lot of variables going on. And then there are service providers. So, you know, we almost feel like the internet should always be there. And it's not necessarily always there. We've had...
Or it's there and we can't reach it.
Right. It's there, but the connection in your location has been severed. Maybe a fiber optic cable got, you know, cut into because of a construction problem.
Yep.
Or a storm caused a down line. You know, the storm that happened over a week ago, you know, took out
those really high winds.
A lot of things.
And, yeah.
And lightning, I've seen it get into lines in businesses and actually pop out and char cards in computers. So,
wow.
You know, lightning is very powerful. So, you know, there's a lot of things that factor into what can be the underlying cause of the problem. So how can you approach some of these things other than taking notes and searching for answers? Have alternative ways to access your email. Maybe try it with your phone. Or if you have a smartphone, know the alternatives, not only downloading email, but maybe you have, you could have a Google Gmail account or Yahoo account and so forth. Or you could use mail, M-A-I-L, the number 2, and then W-E-B.com and log into that. Sometimes web services or email services also have alternative ways to get into it. So if you're with like Charter or TDS or Roadrunner, they have their email access online. Have another web browser to use and think that, well, maybe I connect one way and it's not working. Maybe if I try with another one, right. maybe it's the software, the browser on your machine that's
right.
having
so
a problem.
So if you're having problems in Internet Explorer, try Firefox or try Safari or vice versa. Yeah.
Right, correct. And then, you know, there are other things like doing system restore in Windows and Time Machine on the Apple. Those both have different approaches to doing a system restore, but be aware that those are tools available to you, mm-hmm. and you should familiarize yourself with them so that you understand it in case you ever have to use it. Because what ends up happening is if you don't use it, and then you call somebody in and you're paying them X dollars an hour, they might actually be using it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could call up and someone would say, well, I recommend that you do this. So, you know, you hear about it, but maybe taking the time to research it, and Microsoft puts up white papers on their website, and they have support. A lot of people have put up support things and tutorials mm-hmm. using YouTube and looking at tutorials for that. Also with Apple, the same approach. Apple has a lot of information on their site. And then doing a system upgrade, an OS or an operating system upgrade, you need to make sure your system is working well before you do that. That's not a cure.
That's not a cure.
Yeah, okay. They may just make the problem even worse. So don't think just upgrading from one OS to another mm-hmm. is going to actually make the problem go away. And we've talked about that before. So, you know, there's a lot to think about, but if you're prepared and you can take some educated approaches to solving, you know, what might be small now but bigger later, mm-hmm. you're ahead of the game.
And if your computer is crashing fairly frequently, Peter, in that case, the notes you would be taking is, I was using Word and it crashed, or mm-hmm. I was using, and I also had X, Y, and Z programs open. What mm-hmm. kind of information would be helpful to say, you know, either a technician at a big box store or an independent consultant like yourself, or, you know, what kind of information would be helpful for them to help you figure out what's going on?
Well, the specifics is related to when it crashes, what is it doing? You know, how is it behaving? And then when I see multiple occurrences, I typically would recommend doing an operating system repair in a Windows environment, which is something that is documented online, and you need the software, the operating system disk, to allow you to do that. But what it will do, and there are some other tools you can download, but it basically goes out there onto your system and it checks and validates the key operating system files that it needs to work and make sure that, I guess I use the term stepped on, or, you know, that they got trashed
mm-hmm.
and they get replaced. But you can only do that with a valid disk. You can't just, you know, try to do it and not have the tools.
Mm-hmm.
You need, so the software is important to have. So well, make sure you keep track of that
keep
stuff.
Keep track of those
There's
things.
So many times I ask people for that. And it takes them weeks.
If they ever find it, right? Well, we will definitely keep talking about different aspects of knowing when to hit the panic button or not with Peter Green. He is an independent computer consultant, and he is in charge of the Infostar.com website, which has great information about keeping your computer running well and useful websites. Let's go to the phone, since there are quite a few people anxious to talk with you, Peter. Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about my nice new Dell laptop that runs Windows 7, and the one piece of software I'd like to run on it that I haven't yet is an old software package that runs on XP. If I can dig out those XP operating system disks, can I install XP on a partition and run an XP program on a 64-bit Windows 7 computer?
Boy, that's a good question. You have some software that's for XP that you want to try and run.
Yeah.
Correct? Windows 7 has an XP compatibility mode.
Oh.
So you may luck out and be able to install the software using that. I haven't done much with that in a while. But it's documented, and the key thing is knowing, and I'm sure your software probably has it, but for all those people that are listening, It's not something that they gave that they gave the ability to every version of Windows 7 that they sell, which is kind of frustrating. It's like, just sell one version of the operating system, you know, like what Apple does. It's
right.
very simple. But you can go online and look for XP compatibility mode in Windows 7 and see what setting, you know, how to actually do that for that software rather than going through and setting up a separate partition. Because one of the issues, unless it's changed and someone's listening and knows different, you really need to set up those partitions prior to, you know, using the entire drive. In other words, you can't back off. Let's say a hard drive is 500 gigabytes. You can't say, okay, well, I want to allocate 50 to be for XP and 450 for Windows 7. Now, in an Apple environment, you could use something like Parallels for the desktop and actually allocate a portion of that 500 for a Windows or another operating system, but typically Windows, partition, and it will use that space within the 500. But for multiple Windows partitions, usually they're set up, you know, when you're slicing out the drive space.
Do you know if the compatibility mode will work? Since my new computer runs on 64-bit, will it work with an old program that isn't 64-bit?
Well, the idea is that the XP compatibility mode is kind of like using a virtual memory manager to say this is you're running in, you know, a 16-bit mode for running the XP software, but you don't. They have a list of programs that they qualify, but there's, you know, it's almost like a trial, to me, a trial and error. You don't, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then it doesn't.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Bill. And let's go to Randy in Waukesha next. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
What's your question?
I got a laptop computer with Windows Vista, and I went on the internet about a week ago. And everything was fine, and then all of a sudden, it's just like the whole screen, everything went real, like about the size of a postage stamp, all the print and everything. But yeah, I mean, you can't read it, it's so small. So there's, I don't know, it's only, like only if I go into the internet, I tried a different connection, different wireless connection, and it's the same thing. I'm not really sure what to do.
And so is it the windows themselves on your browser that are tiny, or just the print that's on them?
It's the whole thing. It's just like you're reading a web page, only it's the whole thing is just shrunk down to maybe about the size of a postage stamp, or about half that size. It's real tiny. You can't even read it or anything.
Okay. Well, let's see what Peter has to say.
The rest of your system, as far as anything else you use on it, visually, it's fine.
Right, the rest of it seems to be fine. Like, I booted off, it seems to be normal size and everything like that.
But okay.
Once I get on the internet, then I try to, you know, go to a website or something, and then all of a sudden it'll just, you know, just come up with a real teeny tiny little.
Now, do you have an alternative web browser you use? It sounds like you use primarily one.
Yeah, I think it's Explorer, I think, is what I'm using.
Yeah, do you have anything else to try, or no?
Not that I know of, really. I mean, I just kind of like Google or whatever, you know. But
So this is a good case where having an alternative web browser would come in handy, because then you could test and see if. To me, it sounds like it's the settings within Internet Explorer.
Yeah, something got changed there, maybe.
how can you fix that? What you need to do is, if you open up Internet Explorer, I forgot the exact way to do this, but you can dynamically resize the screen. So if you hold the control key down and, you said a laptop, I know with a mouse, if you have the control key down and you hit the scroll wheel up or down, It'll dynamically resize the screen. If you have a slide pad, holding the control key down and the act of sliding it up will probably increase the size of your screen.
Okay.
So, and then, and if you can get the window large enough to do it, you could also go to, is it Mozilla.com to download Firefox?
Yep.
And then you could at least have that as a second browser, like Peter was saying, you know, to kind of do process of elimination for what problems might be.
Yep. Google Chrome is another good one, too. I'm not sure. Footprint size, I think Chrome might be a little bit smaller to download.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then what do you think, like a system restore, would that do anything to help you?
No, I think probably some setting got changed accidentally, and if you're able to resize the screen back, you can probably go across the top menu in Internet Explorer, and you'll see there are some settings you might be able to change as far as, sizing of the screen and things like that.
And if you have access to somebody else's computer or, say, a library computer, you could also go into Internet Explorer and look at those options. So at least you know where you're heading, being able to look at it full size, and then maybe you can find it.
I'm making the general observation assumption from what you're telling me that things are pretty darn tiny.
Right. I mean, you can't. Can't read, like I say, it's maybe like half the size of a postage stamp.
Right.
You can see the print is all there, but it's just so tiny.
Wow.
You have to have a microscope to read it.
So if you can get it open, then hold the control key down and use the slide pad and increase the size.
All right, good luck with that, Randy. Let us know how it works. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller with Peter Green of Infostar.com. We're talking about personal computers and how to fix problems. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. We are talking about personal computers with Peter Green of Infostar.com. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and just want to let you know that Larry will be back behind the microphone next Monday. So didn't want you to be worrying that he was gone on an extended leave. He's just taking a little well-deserved vacation time. So let's go back to the phones, Peter, and talk with Gary and Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a Apple PowerMac G4. And I'm assuming that anything that comes up on the screen when I boot up is on the hard drive. And I was wondering, I can't seem to figure out how to erase things off from the hard drive to give me more room on there.
So you're talking about looking at things that are on your desktop.
Right.
Okay. You can drag them to the trash.
Drag them to the trash.
Yep.
Even if it's an application.
Well, that if it's an application,
see, I uploaded some photographs, and they get classified as an application.
That doesn't. If you click on an item on your desktop, and it's associated with an application, it's going to open up the application to allow you to view the file. But if it's an application icon and you click on it, it will open up the application, but it won't open up any file because there's nothing associated with it until you tell it. Do you follow the difference?
Well, I think not.
In other words,
if I click on application, these things all come up as part of an application.
What are the names of them? What kind of names are you
saying? I think they're just JPEG files.
Okay, JPEG files are pictures. So they could be either pictures from your camera, if it was attached, or they could be files, pictures that were downloaded over the internet. But something that's sitting on your desktop, if you click on that and it has a name, I'll just give you an example. An application like Photoshop. You're going to see Photoshop, the name, and you'll click on that. It will open up the application, but nothing will pop open. But if you click on a picture named Photoshop, and it's the picture of the cover of the manual for Photoshop, it's going to show you that picture.
And that's just an image. That's an item. It's not an application.
Right. So if you were to drag that image to the trash, then it would actually be removed.
Just click on it and hold it down.
And then,
it down.
Yep, exactly. Then the next act would be to go to the trash on a Mac, in a PC, a recycle bin, and actually, you know, empty out the trash so that you really don't want that file anymore.
Right, because...
And then it cleans this, it removes it from the system.
Because if the issue, Peter, as Gary was saying,
space.
Is space, right. It's basically when it's in the trash or the recycle bin, it's still there.
Right.
It's still taking up space.
The operating system, I'm not sure on the Apple, but in Windows, it would put this letter E invisibly in front of the file name, which means that it's marked for the space on the drive is marked for reuse by the operating system. So there are utilities still out there that allow you to recover files that have actually been removed from the recycle bin or removed from the trash can. Mm-hmm. But if you continue to use your system, the space has been marked for reuse, so the likelihood of recovering files is a lot less likely to happen. Because I call that forensics and computer forensics.
Right,
I mean,
right,
you're,
sure.
you know, someone says, okay, they erased the hard drive. You know, is there any way to get back what they said that they erased? And I said, yeah, you can attempt to do certain things, but if it's been reused, then those files get files. Allocated space gets written over.
Right. And I think, if I'm remembering, it's been a little while since I've had a Mac, but I think you can drag an application to the trash like you would an item if you want to get rid of it. I think it will actually ask you, are you sure this is an application file?
Yeah,
are you sure you want to get rid
of this? I love those,
are you sure? Are you really sure? Because there's no going back. But I think that's another way, you know, if Gary is not sure what they are, I think it will actually ask if it's an application or not. All right. Well, good luck with that, Gary. And let's go to James in Mount Prospect, Illinois. Hi, James.
Hi. Hey. My name is Jim Jelke.
Yeah.
And I have a question about compatibility between Windows and Macintosh operating systems. We received a video that's a WMV file from preschool about what the kids have been doing during the year. And some of the people who would like to use it don't have Windows computers. They have Macintoshes. And it just doesn't work. So I went on the web and browsed a little bit, and I find some, you might almost say, professional-looking or slick-looking websites that say, here's an application, download it, and it will allow you to either run the file or to convert the file. And I wonder if that's the best way to do it, or is there just something I'm not aware of about, like, maybe enhancing iTunes or whatever the iMovie, whatever the stuff on the Macintosh is that allows you to do video.
I'm surprised that the Mac won't open. And what was the suffix?
WMV, Windows WMV. Media Video.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one thing you might want to try to consider is just simply uploading it to, like, a YouTube account.
That's what I was
thinking. And there are some other, you know, online video places, and just let the web application deal with it. And that way, you know, you just point people to the link.
And I think you can, I'm just thinking, since James said it was preschoolers, you know, there might be some privacy issues. But I think even on YouTube, you can limit who can see it.
Yep.
Okay. Very good.
Sure. And I think also, I mean, you could upload it there, and then if people want, you know, to have it on their own computer, instead of, you know, having to go to YouTube, they could then download it from there. So you might be able to even use YouTube as kind of a translator.
Yeah, there's YouTube, and there are some other services if you go out there to do you know, share videos. You'll probably find easily more than a handful of them. I know I've mentioned a number of them on top 10 selections, because people post photos and videos and things like that. And it's not necessarily like a YouTube quality thing, but it's something maybe like a camping trip that a group of people took together, or, you know, an outing of, you know, a family reunion and things like that. And, you know, it just simplifies sharing that stuff.
I've also found, Peter, sometimes it seems that if you, say, download a video or something that someone sends you as an attachment, if you just try to click it, the computer doesn't necessarily know what to do with it, but if you download it and then say open iMovie and then choose that file and open it, so even just the order in which you kind of go at it might be worth trying
because the computer doesn't always have the association set up, even though you think you should be able to run it. It doesn't. It may be the first time that the user is trying to do that, and because the system's never seen it before, there is this disconnect, and the user has to make that connection. And if they don't know how to do it, then they'll never
make it. You kind of have to help them a little bit. Yeah, so James, you can also suggest to the folks that are using Macs to download the movie and then open iMovie on its own and then through iMovie do an open file and open the movie and see if that works. So good luck with that. And Neil,
nice tip, Judith.
Oh, sure. I do what I can to earn my key pair, Peter. Neil and Toma is next. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hi.
I was flipping through the channel dial as I was driving, and I'm now between Toma and the Dells, and I heard the guy with the postage stamp size website.
Yes.
So I thought I would call in. His Zoom has been set to 10%.
Ah, instead of 100.
Under, right. And if he goes to the file edit view menu, under view, it's Zoom, and he can change that. And it was probably done with the, you know, the control key and the and stroking the mouse pad accidentally.
Okay.
Like you already covered.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's but that's some good detail. So the Zoom and or, you know, it could have been possible that for some reason that field was active and in, you know, somehow got 10 instead of 100 for 10% instead of 100%. So that's great.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully he's still listening so he can get back to actually seeing what's in his browser window.
Yes, and there's one other thing that a lot of people don't know. Once you've added a whole bunch of software to the machine and they've thrown toolbars in Internet Explorer, sometimes those toolbars and add-ons and browser help objects can really mess up going to a banking site or some of the sites that you really want to go to. And it's kind of obscure, but there's a way to start Internet Explorer without any of those add-ons. And it's a good diagnostic tool. It's usually in, when you go to Start and Accessories and System Tools, there's one that's labeled Internet Explorer, no add-ons.
Oh, okay. Peter?
Yep.
So if you're having trouble
with a
website, try it without add-ons, if it works.
Great. Yeah, and I think that goes back to what you were talking about, Peter, is having these kind of things in your toolkit.
Yep.
So when something goes wrong, you have a few things that you can try before hitting that panic button.
Yep. Now, there's one other thing I'm going to add, and I've got a link to it. I've probably had it up for the past 3 months on the Web Top 10, is someone came up with a God mode link in Windows 7. And because Internet Explorer is so ingrained and meshed into the operating system, I would not be surprised if that God mode link actually had the settings for not only the changing the view, but also for the loading Internet Explorer without the add-ons. Would be a checkbox that you could probably find in that God mode.
There you go. And again, you know, just plug God mode into your,
you can
into
do
your
a search
engine.
And you can do a search. I put the link up there just to make sure that you could find it.
Great. And thanks so much for that call, Neil. It's always great, when callers help other callers. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking with Peter Green of Infostar.com. We're talking about all things personal computer related, and we'd be happy to take your call, too. It's 1-800-642-1234 to join in. Again, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer, will get those messages through to us. And let's go to Dennis in Toma next. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning to you all. How or what kind of a book that may be written that would explain all of these acronyms and so forth. I'm totally illiterate when it comes to a computer. Just starting out, I'm retired. I want to start doing something instead of just sitting around.
Well, first of all, Dennis, I want to say good for you for tackling it. And I think like anything new, it can be kind of intimidating, and especially something that changes as quickly and develops as quickly as computers. So I think Dennis's question is really helpful, not just for him, but for a lot of people.
Yeah, they've come out with they used to have the series for dummies.
Something for dummies.
But in the computer world, there's a series of books that have been written called Missing Manuals, and it covers a wide variety of topics. So there might be a missing manual for Windows 7, a missing manual for Mac Lion operating system, missing manual for QuickBooks. It's kind of like pick your topic and see if it's available for it.
I think Dennis is even talking about a step or two before that.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I would suggest is checking out classes at senior centers, mm-hmm. at here in Madison, the Madison Schools and Recreation have different classes, and libraries are a great resource for, mm-hmm. for classes like that. Where else would you send people, Peter?
I would say, you know, go to a local computer store if there's one close by, and see if they offer classes. One nice thing about coming from the stores is it's usually based on experience, real world experience, and stuff that you're likely to, you know, go through.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that you might see at junior colleges, or tech colleges, might be a little bit advanced, but you can always talk to the instructor and ask what's covered and tell them what you're looking for, what you want to get out of it, and see if it's worth, you know, pursuing. It's always good to talk to the instructor and find out what you're looking for and where they're going with mm-hmm. their class content and see if it applies.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, do you have any grandchildren?
No, not yet. But
well, maybe you could borrow one because they could probably talk you through some stuff too.
I have gone to several courses which teaches you how to turn it on, turn it off. I realize now that you never hit the delete button. I can use Word and I can use Excel and I understand uh-huh. those. But when you get into the specific stuff on the toolbar,
mm-hmm.
and you have several previous callers have brought that up in your explanation, that's where I have the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, if it go into my computer, you know, and then all of a sudden I got a whole bunch of stuff, and I'm deathly afraid to explore something, and because it has happened where I wound up botching up the computer and have to have it reset.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I have a hang up, and I'm deathly afraid to continue doing that, for, you know, because I'm always taking my computer in to have it reset.
Well,
and obviously, I'm doing something wrong to drop my system.
What I would also look at exploring online are some of the tech forums. If you go to Infostar.com, on the very top on the left-hand side, if you go to the Virus Info Center page, on the very top of that page, I have access to all these different tech forums. And probably in your case, I would try to find maybe one or two that seem to cater to what you know your level of mm-hmm. experience. And so key in some questions and do some, you know, find out, you know, the search results and read through them, and you'll get a feel for, you know, what kind of people are on there and what kind of help they're looking for. And just typing in questions and reading answers, whether it's a right or a wrong answer to your question, you learn how to ask that question
right.
better. And you'll start feeling more comfortable about what's the next step to do. Some of these pages are also resources where they may have tutorials that are step-by-step of how to actually go through and make a change to a setting or solve a problem.
Mm-hmm. How to troubleshoot different things.
It's like connect the dots to help you feel more comfortable about how to do that.
Well, good luck, Dennis, and give us an update sometime. Let us know how you're progressing. Let's go to Tom in Pewaukee next. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Judith, and morning, Peter.
Hi.
I'm hoping there's a real easy answer to my problem here. I'm having, I think, what you call shortcut issues on the desktop. For example, I have got my Internet Explorer out on the desktop as a shortcut, but I also have some JPEG files also, like the one caller was talking about, and that's the actual file itself. And what happens is I'll, for example, open up the picture, click on it, and it opens up fine. But when I close it, then I can't open it again. It's just like the shortcut or whatever, the icon stops working. Same way with Internet Explorer. I can use it once, but I can't use it again. And the only way I can get my icons to start working again is to just reboot the whole system, refresh it all, and then they work again, but only for one time. So do you know what would be causing that?
You might have some bad registry links that seem to be getting it, you know, in the way of relaunching your application. So what I would probably do is, which version of Windows are you using?
I'm using Windows 7.
Okay. If you go into Users off of your main C drive and then locate your actual user identity and then go into that folder and then locate your desktop, you'll find those picture files. I would move those picture files to a folder so you know where they are, if those are the, because you shouldn't have a lot of those on your desktop. The more icons you have on your desktop, the more it slows down Windows. So actually have less things on your desktop will make your system a little bit faster.
Well, that's good advice.
But if you've got
a
super duper computer, it may not be an issue. But if you move those pictures to a folder so it's more organized, and then also, you know, you should back them up if there are things that you want to save. And then if you haven't used a program called CCleaner before, I would recommend downloading that. And that will go through and eliminate or remove bad links in your system registry.
And C is like the letter C, like C drive, which is usually your main hard drive.
So it's C and then Cleaner. And if you do search on that, the company is called Piriform, P-I-R-I, Forms. And you can go out there and do searches on how to use it. You know, their website's useful, but, you know, there are other people who have been using it for years.
Is that a free downloadable program?
Yeah, it's a free download. When you go to their site, just make sure that you pay attention. I usually download it from their site. There are other sites you can download from, but they may bug you with some other things. So I usually elect to download it from them. They ask for donations, but it's a free utility.
Well, I use something called AVG for my antivirus and all that good stuff.
Sure.
And they've got something called AVG tune-up, and it's supposed to speed up your computer and do all kinds of things. But I think it's like about, I don't know, $38 or something they want for that. And I'm just wondering if that's worth spending the money to do that.
No, I would use the CCleaner.
All right.
Yeah, I don't like paying for things if I can get away with it, and
if it's a good quality product.
The CCleaner utility has been it's been well tested and used quite a bit. You can actually go to another website called cnet.com, and you could probably, you know, read online reviews and see how many downloads and what other users think about it, and what their experiences are.
Great. Thanks for that call, Tom. And I am, as we speak, adding to my to-do list, get rid of all those extra files on my desktop, because I didn't realize that would actually have an impact. I love how our callers help out other listeners. So Bruce posted on Facebook, for the person wanting to play WMV files on a Mac, Microsoft offers a QuickTime plugin called Flip for Mac, and it's Flip, the number for Mac. It's a go-to solution for the issue. So it sounds like it's an add-on that will convert them easily for the Mac. Also, Jamie emailed to say VLC Video LAN Media Player can open and play almost any video file. It works on all operating systems. It's free and open source. So thanks to both of you for that information. We're talking about personal computers with Peter Green of Infostar.com. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Talking about personal computer problems with Peter Green of Infostar.com. And Peter, as usual, there are many people waiting to talk with you. So let's go back to the phones. Judy in Madison is next. Hi, Judy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi.
My favorite program all month.
All right.
Recently, I've started having a problem opening PDF files. And I get a message that tells me that it is the PDF reader, whatever, as part of my Adobe Photoshop program, and I have to open a Photoshop before I can open the PDF. How do I change that?
And this is just to read PDFs, right? Not necessarily edit them?
Right. It's just to read them.
Okay. Peter, what do you think?
What operating system are you using?
XP.
Okay. one thing that I would try to do, Have you downloaded the latest version of Adobe Reader? Have you tried that?
I don't think so.
Okay. That would be one thing I would try to do, is to just simply upgrade the reader and see if that makes the problem go away. If that doesn't make the problem go away, what you need to do is go into Windows Explorer, and you could do a search on this online, but you need to change the file type association in Windows so that it associates .pdf with the reader, and that's done in the Windows Explorer.
And so basically you're telling the computer, whenever you see this kind of a file, this is what I want you to open
correct.
It with.
Yep.
And
somehow the association got, you know,
hijacked
or misplaced or misassociated.
Okay, and is that an easy step-by-step thing to do?
There are online tutorials that I've you know, found. So it would be Windows Explorer. Change file type association. And usually people have done like print screens or, you know, show you where it's located. And I would add Windows XP to that.
Okay.
So Windows Explorer is typically the folder icon, and it's found, if you click on Start and then Accessories, usually you find Windows Explorer. It's not the Internet Explorer. It's the Windows Explorer, which allows you to manage files, file types and things like that on your system. It's the tool you use for good computer housekeeping.
And it sounds, Peter, like a good first step would be updating Reader to make sure that's
not the
issue.
Yeah, I would try the Reader update first. That's probably a little bit easier. But the other thing is related to understanding the file type associations can help people in terms of when they download files over the internet and they're not sure what they're associated with, that's the way to change that, you know, so that if you need to change the file association type because you've downloaded a file and you don't know how to open it, but you think you're getting it for a certain program that's on your system and it's misaligned, that's the place to change that. And I know we've had questions about that over the years.
Right. Great. Well, good luck with that, Judy. And let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I'd like to know if you're familiar with this error message. No audio output device is installed. It appears on my laptop erratically. Sometimes when I boot up, my audio output is fine, and sometimes there is no audio output, and you get that error message when you put your mouse pointer on the little icon at the bottom right of the screen. I've Googled that message, and there seem to be 100 possible fixes. Some of them are extremely elaborate, involving uninstalling drivers and reinstalling drivers. But this problem comes and goes with no apparent reason. Have you run into this before?
I've run into a variety of problems with audio drivers. Sometimes it occurs with software installations. Sometimes it occurs with flaky computer equipment. Sometimes it occurs because device drivers that were written are flaky. And one thing I would recommend to do is to, number one, know what your audio device is. You know, if it's like Sound Blaster was very popular, there could be others. I mean, there are others out there. Is to see what you have on your system. And you can do that through the control panel and then go through the audio, the sound part, the multimedia part of your system and identify it that way. There are other tools to help you identify what you have in your system. Belarc Advisor, B-E-L-A-R-C, Advisor is a software tool that you can download, and it'll give you oodles of reports about what's in your system. And then there's another tool from the makers of CCleaner. I think it's S-P-E-C-C-V-Y is their the name for their product. But you can go to Puriforms and look for that. And again, it analyzes your system and it will give you the information. Then what I would do is go to your manufacturer's site for your computer, your laptop, and I would see if you have the latest version. And maybe you might want to just, if you do have the latest version, is to maybe reinstall it and see if that helps. If you don't have the latest version, you're probably going to want to download it and install the latest or upgrade to the latest version of that driver and see if that helps.
Do you associate this error message with one operating system more than another? I suspect Windows Vista.
Vista had a number of issues. I don't want to point my finger to say it specifically, you know, the audio,
that, yeah.
That it's necessarily the audio part that, you know, that's one of them. But, you know, going down the path of making sure the device drivers on your system are current would probably be a good thing. And if you haven't already done that, that's what the path that I would go. As far as, you know, thinking about upgrading to Windows 7, you know, that's something that you can look at. In this case, that wouldn't hold me back from upgrading the system because of the audio part, but I would definitely research making sure I have all the current device drivers.
All right, good luck with that, Charlie. And let's take a quick call from Steve in Wausau. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple weeks ago, when we were listening, you mentioned some sort of modem that you found at Best Buy, I believe, and you could download movies from the modem on your computer over to your television. And I kind of missed. Could you go over that again if you remember what that was?
I think you were referring to if you already have an internet connection. There are a variety of products out there. One is Roku. R-O-K-U, which will allow you to be connected to the internet, and it has its own menuing system that allows you to have access to online videos through them. And then, you know, if you had Netflix, you would be able to, it's almost got like its own browser to be able to do those kinds of things.
And then how does it get to the TV?
It has to be hooked up to the TV, depending upon the Roku device. And again, there are other devices out there. I believe Apple TV is one. But Roku caters to being able to hook up the the internet to just a simple TV. So if you have, hopefully, composite jacks, you don't need HDMI to hook it up to a TV. But the TV does need to have some kind of composite jack, which are those RCA, the white, the red, and the yellow, so that you can get the audio and the video sound from coming from the Roku and the internet to the TV. So you could still, what I would call, connect to an old school TV. The newer TVs typically use the HDMI, which is delivering the sound and the high-end video.
Okay. Does that sound like what you were looking for, Steve?
Yeah, but that how did you say that? Roku? Is that
R-O-K-U.
And where can you purchase that, or what?
You can purchase it. You might be able to find it at Target and Walmart. If you can get online, go to Roku.com. They have a website, and they have the products for sale that way. But you might be able to find some specials locally. I'm sure Walmart carries it, because I bought one through one of their stores. So.
Great. Well, thanks for that reminder, Steve, because I know that was something a lot of people were interested in. We're talking with Peter Green of Infostar.com about personal computers. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. I hope you'll stay tuned. Computers can be a tool or a toy, or sometimes both at the same time. But however we use them, it can be hard to keep up with the latest news and product releases. Do you feel like you're keeping up with new developments, or worry that you might be missing out on helpful improvements? Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Green of Infostar is here for the next half hour to give us advice and to answer your questions. He'll also share this month's top 10 list of useful websites. What's going on with your computer? If the worst happened and it crashed, how much would you lose? I hope you'll join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. You could also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Like the page to receive regular updates on upcoming show topics. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back with much more with Peter Green right after this look at the news. Well, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, personal computer ownership has increased dramatically over the past 10 years. At the beginning of the decade, starting with the year 2000, 51% of homes had a personal computer and 42% had internet access. But by 2009, nearly 70% of U.S. households were estimated to be using the internet at home. With that many of us using computers at home, let alone the ones we use for work, we rely on them quite a bit. And we rely on Peter Green, too. He's an independent computer consultant, and he comes by the first Monday of each month to help us all with our computer problems. Peter, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Always great, Judith.
Well, before we get back to the phones, it's this time each month that we go over the top 10, or in this case, 11 lists for June. Peter puts a lot of time into choosing really interesting websites, and you can find all of these at Infostar.com, and there is a direct link to this month's top 10 list on our Facebook page. And I like to spell Larry's name because it's not always evident. It's Mueller, M-E-I-L-L-E-R. So it's The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. But you can get it without going through the Facebook page by going to Infostar.com. So what do you have for us this month, Peter?
Well, I've got some tech ones and some beekeeping ones.
and I have to say, Peter didn't even realize that we had done a beekeeping show about a week ago.
I missed that one.
So we just have this psychic connection.
Might have turned me the other way.
There you go. You might have brought bees along instead of a computer today. So what do you have?
So the first one is osxdaily.com. And if you guessed it, it covers the Mac OS X operating system, but it also includes iPad, iPhone, and other related topics.
And so is it a news aggregator kind of thing? Or?
Yeah. I mean, it's got tips and news and you know, what's coming out and rumors. There are a lot of always rumor sites.
I especially like the name of the next one.
Yep. TrickyWays.com. Just like it sounds, Tricky and Ways, W-A-Y-S.com. It's another tech resource, same thing, focus on tips and tricks for now cross-platform. So it's got Android, iPad, iPhone, OS X, Microsoft Office, the PSP, and Windows 7 and more. So it covers quite a few more. Then we're moving forward to carcare.org, and it's actually put up by the Automotive Aftermarket Industry Association to make us more aware of what it is, how important it is for regular car care maintenance. And, you know, the simple things like just knowing when to change your oil.
Right.
Now, something that I've been doing for years, I'm just going to share a little tip.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Consumer Reports doing this a long time ago, and they said, save on the environment, save your money, save the oil. I personally have done this for probably close to 20 years, is I change my oil every 7,000 miles, and that's when I rotate my tires, and I do them both at the same time, and I have never blown an engine because of that, so
at least the old conventional wisdom was every 3,000, right?
Well, I remember when it was 2,500, and then it was 3,000, okay. Yep, and so...
Good car tips there, carcare.org.
Yep. Number four, Intercept Radio, .com. They claim to be the world's largest radio scanner frequency database, and I gave a quick link to the state of Wisconsin map showing all those frequencies. Hmm. Number five is masterbeekeeper.org, and... this came up from after a hockey outing game,
<Of course.
laughs> game where we started talking about beekeeping. And I said, oh, I took a class from Professor Roger Morse at Cornell. And I went online to look, and lo and behold, here's a great resource that's for beekeepers. Number six is pleasebringit.com. Please bring and then IT.com, and it's a free resource to help you organize people and events. It works great, personal experience. Number seven, PeopleSmart. They launched in September 2010, and it's an internet search engine to help you look up contact info and a whole bunch of other personal information if you want to see if it's out there.
And is there a fee associated with that, or is that free?
I believe there's a fee associated with some of it. And this other one that's kind of related to it, the next one, number eight, is webmii.com. And what's interesting about this is you can look for the information, but they're also trying to give it a score of how visible you are.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So, you know, just another thing to play with online. Occupy your time other than Facebook and email. Number nine is if maybe you find your next favorite book online, it's just a resource. Check out if you like reading. It's called goodreads.com.
And you can track your progress on that, too. I have a friend who's working his way through Crime and Punishment, which is one of my favorite books and not the easiest read. And he'll post that he's, you know, on page whatever, you know, 62 of 400 and something. And I give him a little encouraging message to keep
on going.
There's
also, I think, a Listopedia, some list thing up there for just good reads.
Okay.
Number 10 is outdoorphotographer.com, and they claim to have 27 plus thousand digital subscribers to their e-zine or online magazine, and they post a lot of useful tips. For example, if you're taking pictures of wildlife, they've got lighting for wildlife. And then, like you mentioned, or like we mentioned earlier, there's a God mode link that I leave up there so people have access to it. And it's for Windows 7.
All right. Thank you, Peter. And again, that's the top 11 list of useful websites available at infostar.com. Just go to the current top 10 list link there. And Peter, we have some folks that have been waiting quite a while to talk with you. So let's go to the phones. Ron in Milwaukee's next. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
What's your question?
I've got two easy questions, hopefully. Easy answers, I'm sorry. When I go to log on, and I never turn off my computer, just in a sleep mode, it comes up on the screen, overrange. What does that mean, and how do I eliminate it not happening? And it comes up, I would say, generally, and I keep a log, and I'm not by the computer now, but once a month or maybe even oftener. Now, similarly, I ask for my password occasionally, once a month, maybe twice a month. I don't know if they're related. They're just coincidence, but I keep a log of those things, too. But I'm the overload, I just can't go any further than that. Any thoughts there?
Well, one thing is, you said overrange?
Overrange, yes.
Yeah.
Did I use the word overload? No, it's overrange. Yes, overrange.
I don't know if I've ever seen that message before, but if you leave your system on all the time, do you ever reboot it?
Well, that's what I have to do when it says that.
Okay.
I can't go beyond that.
Yeah. Have you done anything as related to your system registry? You know,
I have no idea what that means.
Okay. You might have some system registry links that are bad, and usually when I see problems like that, I'll do a registry clean. The program or software that we mentioned before, CCleaner, is a good program to do that. The other thing is, you said you try to leave your system on all the time. You may want to take a look at your power options for your system and see what kind of things you have turned off or what you're saving, what the system thinks it's saving power on. Typically, if you're using it to access the internet and you're plugged in hardwire, I usually don't like to save power or have a power saving setting as related to the Ethernet card, because I find that causes a problem. So there are different things that you can make changes to, and that might be one of them. And then as related to periodically asking you for your password, there might be a time setting on your password when your system goes into the sleep mode or the screensaver, and you can go into the control panel, or actually right mouse click on your desktop and go into properties and take a look and see if you want to turn it off so it doesn't ask you for your password, or if you want to extend the time.
Mm-hmm. Although, of course, that is something of a security.
It just depends on the environment that it's in.
Yeah. And Ron, you had another question also?
Well, those were the two questions.
Oh, okay. All right.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The other question was, when I want to, I look up at a recipe, mm-hmm. and on the screen it's full size, but when I go to print it, it's very small print.
Okay. What are you using to print with?
What kind of printer?
No, are you using like Internet Explorer, Mozilla, Firefox?
Are these recipes from the internet?
Actually,
from the internet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's Explorer, yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a number of things you can do. One is sometimes I simply highlight what I...
Excuse me. They're not always that way, but
when
I did it last night, that's the way it was.
Yeah. It depends on the website and how they're trying to display the information to you. One is to use Internet Explorer, Mozilla, Firefox, whatever browser you're using, and do a preview print to take a look at and see what it's going to look like.
Right.
And then you can edit, you can make changes to what the output is going to be. The other thing is, if I don't want, make sure that you're only printing the pages that you need. Don't print, just say go ahead and print, because it may have like 3 or 4 or 7 pages and you don't need all
that.
Right,
and sometimes all the comments.
Right.
And
the other trick that I use is sometimes I just want one part of that screen, is I'll highlight it. So I'll use my mouse or my slide pad, and I'll highlight that. So you hold the shift key down, and then you just slide across that screen. And then I'll press control C, which is to copy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll paste it into Microsoft Word or whatever I want to use, or might be Paint or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And press control V or paste it. And then I'm just printing that part that I need.
Yeah.
And not the whole thing.
And another thing, Ron, is there are two different ways of printing something. If it's on a site, say Epicurious or Cooking Light or one of those websites where they're used to people coming there and wanting the recipes, as opposed to, say, a recipe that's just in the middle of a newspaper article or something, there's often an icon on that page with the recipe that says print this recipe. Mm-hmm. And that's going to give you a much simpler, trimmed down version of that window, instead of going to print on the toolbar, which is going to print everything, all the ads, all whatever right. is around the recipe. So you might want to also make sure you're zeroing in on a print this recipe or print this page kind of icon too.
Which is what I've done usually. Okay. I've seen that and I've used that. But last night on America's Best Kitchen, I didn't see that on there.
Well, I think Peter's recommendation about just copying and pasting that text is good because then you get just what you want and not all those extras. So thanks for that, Ron, and good luck with that, and hope you're cooking up something tasty as a result. Jeff in Wausau is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Hi, Peter. Hi. What I did was I boosted my computer for video editing of Blu-ray and 3D.
Okay.
I dumped in 8 gigs of RAM, new video card, new power supply. Everything's working good, but I couldn't get no sound out of the old screen because the HMDI cable wouldn't plug into it. I had to use a DVI.
Okay.
Well, I went to a 42-inch plasma that I had extra sitting around the house.
Okay.
And I didn't leave it get carried away where it, you know, ruined it for normal viewing, but I had image retention. And I set it up for 1 minute pixel rotation, and I went to the TV settings and I lowered the brightness as far as I could, removed a screensaver picture that was part of the reason I figured. But is there something about a plasma that it won't work with? Because at work we use large screens for trends and stuff, and it seems like it's no big deal.
Does it
have to be LCD maybe? Or
yeah, I think plasma, of all the screens, I would think that would be susceptible to image burn, plasma would probably be at the top of the list.
Okay, and then since I got you on the phone, and that went pretty quick, I'm starting to get arthritis in my fingers. And do they make a glove yet? Like I used to watch on the old TV science fiction shows where it like replaces the ball or the mouse for an input device, like a joystick.
You mean for playing a game?
No, actually just for scrolling around on a computer and doing, again, video imaging or, you know, editing.
Like
you'd rub your fingers together and we'd go left and you'd...
Yeah, you know, on the Mac they make a power pad or a slide pad that works quite well. I'm sure on a Windows platform they've probably made a competitive product to that. So I would...
All right.
That would probably, I mean, it's probably, I'm trying to remember the dimensions of it. It's probably at least a 4x5 pad. So it's pretty good size, and it you know, uses, you know, it mimics very well, you know, just doing things, just sliding groups of fingers and making computer use easy. You know, as far as the screen burn-in stuff, you know, the more you can do for rotating things on a plasma, the better. You just looking at a plasma screen, you can just tell that it's more likely to have that kind of an issue.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that, Jeff. And let's go to Evelyn and Racine next. But first, I want to let you know that one of your hockey buddies posted on the Facebook page and wonders what kind of ideas for next month's show and list will they be giving you tonight at hockey. So so they're already on the case, Peter. All right, let's go to Evelyn and Racine next. Hi, Evelyn.
Hello. The problem I have, which started around middle of last week, is that something has gotten into my email, and I'm on Internet Explorer with Windows XP, and so it's gotten into my contact list and sending weird messages to all of my contacts. And the question is, what do I do about it? Do I reset my password, or is there something else?
What are you using for your email? Are you using Outlook Express?
It's ATT Yahoo.
ATT Yahoo.
But I'm on Outlook Express for internet.
Well, so your email is going out through Outlook Express. Let's see. One thing I would do is to there's a setting in Outlook Express to turn off automatically sending out your email. And so that's one thing that's going on. the other thing is you probably have your email is in a sense been hijacked because it's being leveraged to send out these messages. So you don't want to send out messages without you knowing. And that's the first step that I would take, is to shut that off. If you don't have any antivirus protection on your system, I would look at probably, you know, there are free ones out there, AVG and Avast. There's another one that you might want to get access to. It's called Malwarebytes, and have it do a scan of your system as well. Any one of those is probably going to find the culprit that's hijacking your email. But the first thing is to turn off sending out your email and messages without you approving it, because that's what's going on right now.
Okay, and again, what would I go into to do that?
In Outlook Express, I believe Tools.
Okay.
And then Options, and then you'll have you'll have to look around in the tabs, but one of them is going to have, I believe, a Send tab, and then in the Send tab, should have the settings where you can click on or off, you know, and also sending email messages timing wise and things like that. It'll have a whole list of things for you to check off.
And so Evelyn also asked about changing her password.
Yeah,
is that one of the
that
first
was
things?
The next thing.
Yeah, changing your password would be done at the Yahoo level.
Okay.
So if you have a Yahoo account, but you're downloading your email into the Outlook Express,
yeah,
is to log into your Yahoo account online and change your password there.
So instead of going just in your Outlook Express, Evelyn, going to the Yahoo Mail
right.
website and
right.
changing it there.
But I would be, I'm very clear on this, make sure that you do a scan of your system to eliminate the culprit before you log online to change your Yahoo email password.
Okay.
Because I don't want you to compromise you going to that site and not having whatever is on your system not eliminated. Mm-hmm. It needs to be eliminated prior to you logging in.
Yeah, I did go into my, I'm on Avast.
Uh-huh.
And I did go, you know, where you can open up the icon in there and mm-hmm. do a scan.
Right.
Which I did.
Mm-hmm.
It took about an hour and a half.
Okay.
And it came up, you know, I did the brief one, and it said no threats
right.
discovered. Mm-hmm. Then I did the other one, which is more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And it came up with a list of five things
yep.
that said they couldn't find the path.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then it gave me some options at the bottom to do, which I didn't understand, so I did nothing.
So, you should make sure it's also updated, because some of these things that get in on your system will prevent you from updating it. So if you haven't updated it, the Avast, make sure that's been done. And then you should probably delete those links that it's found problems with. And then I would reboot the system and run a scan again.
All right. Good luck with that, Evelyn. And just the minute we have left, Lance had a question on Facebook. In Windows 7, I often get a dialog box that inhibits me from changing the name or moving a folder or file. It says it's open in another application, even when it isn't. It's maddening.
There's something. There's got to be something on the system that's trying. If you're in the folder that you're trying to do something with, whether it's rename or delete it, you can't be on it or in it in order to, because it'll just tell you that it's in use.
Okay.
So it can be a little tricky.
So you just kind of have to come at it from different directions.
Well, you just have to make sure that you're not clicking on it, because then it thinks you're active with it.
Okay.
When you go to click on it, you need to, It can be a little tricky, is the best way to put it.
Okay. So you only want to click on it once and then maybe right-click to
correct.
Take a look at, like, rename, I think, would be one of those
right.
options
yep.
there.
Yeah.
So maybe,
so if you click on
yeah.
it and rename it, you know, and then get out of it, then it should work. If it says that it's being used by another application, there might be a setting that's mm-hmm. somehow got flipped that's not typical. And I would probably just do a search online and see what I would come up with.
All right. Well, Peter Green of Infostar.com has been here sharing his expertise and advice with us on personal computers. And here we are at the end of another show. Peter, thanks so much for coming by.
Time flies. Hopefully the summer won't.
Well, we'll see you again on Monday, July 2nd. And tomorrow at 11, entomologist Phil Pelletieri is here with lots of great insect updates. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller.